You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Kevin Clark. He's an artist that lives between the south of France, Frankfurt, and New York, travels around. Kevin, thanks so much for being with us today.
Very happy to be here, Brainerd. Thank you.
There's so much of your work I'd like to talk about, but I'd like to jump right into what you're doing right now. What is happening in the studio now, and what kind of work are you making?
Right now I'm in Frankfurt. I have a studio at a place called Atelier Frankfurt, and I've been working on some commissioned portraits using the DNA and preparing for an exhibition in Berlin in September, which will be based on a collaboration that I'm doing with the artist Charlemagne Palestine.
And can you explain exactly how a commissioned portrait works in your case, like all the steps of it and how that
comes
together?
Well, in the very early days, I would have to draw blood to be able to access the DNA of the people I wanted to portray. So I would invite quite a number of people to my loft, a registered nurse, and a FedEx man, and I would do what we called a drawing. And I would choose six or eight people, and I would have their blood drawn, and that would be sent out to Applied Biosystems in California, and the DNA would be sequenced. It's very much like sending film into a photo lab, but early on, it took months for them to sequence the DNA. Then, at some point, I receive a printout of the specific DNA of the person that I'm portraying. And they've given me something very personal, and I feel quite obligated to then give them something back, you know, with a portrait that's meaningful. So I reflect quite a bit and come up with a kind of approach to an image, which I then develop and photograph. And I combine the DNA sequence from the person either as the kind of graph-like images that come with a standard DNA sequence or with the four-letter genetic alphabet. So everything that goes into the image, all the graphic elements, the typography, the colors, the format, the image itself, are all very much considered as part of the portrait.
And when you look at someone's DNA report, you're pulling really visual patterns from there, right? We're not talking about like the data that you're reading, or it's really visual patterns, right?
It's visual patterns, yes. The first automated DNA sequence was actually created with my blood in the late 80s. I approached Applied Biosystems through James D. Watson, Carrie Mullis, and challenged them to create a sequencing procedure that would be very specific to an individual. That didn't exist at the time, so they said, blood is really expensive, we'll do the experiment, but you have to send us blood. So I did. And the following year, the first automated DNA sequence using PCR was published. It was based on my blood.
It's fascinating. What year was that?
That was 1988, but the publication was in the Journal of Clinical Chemistry in 1989.
Huh. And wasn't it very
expensive? Craig Venter
I'm sorry, go on. Craig Venter was what?
He was an intern on the project.
Huh. And wasn't it very expensive then to sequence DNA? I mean, or after that point, it was never really done then, but you were talking about it taking weeks at first. Wasn't it also enormously expensive then?
It was very expensive then, and it was very time-consuming, and the labs were trying to become profitable. Great investments in those labs. But I was the first person to help create this, and frankly, in the late 80s, throughout the 80s, genetics was not considered sexy in any way, so it's not as if the leading scientists had anybody breaking down their doors. So they were quite happy to help me and have done so ever since.
Huh. So, and where do you, who do you work with now? Are you working with universities on that, or?
I've worked with Cold Spring Harbor Lab with Watson. I've worked with a place called Forensica in San Francisco for forensic DNA. Right now I'm working with a lab in Berlin called LGC Genomics, and I visit them in Berlin occasionally. I've been doing a few kind of forensic projects. I got DNA from Friedrich Schiller for a portrait of Schiller. I got the DNA from his red hair from the National Schiller Museum here in Germany. Also done some portraits recently of Kurt Schwitters, Joseph Beuys, and Dieter Roth.
And so you also had to have Joseph Beuys' DNA?
I got his DNA through through multiples that he'd signed, through the fat on his fingertips from where he signed and from different stamps and things that he licked for different pieces. And I actually assisted him and spent a year with him in 1976-77 here in Germany.
I know that, yeah. If that's okay, let's jump back to that time for a minute.
Okay.
The year you spent working with Beuys, because, of course, he's a fantastic figure, really kind of mythic to me. So what was that like? What was he like, and his influence on you, or vice versa?
That was a huge influence. I first met him in New York through my professor at Cooper Union, Hans Hacke. Hans clued us into the exhibitions that were happening at Gallery René Bloch in Soho. So I had missed the Coyote piece, but I saw the second big exhibition with the blackboards. I met Beuys at that time. He invited me to come to Basel and assist him in an installation in, I think it was October, November, 1976, and then in
And that was for
spring,
Documenta he was talking about?
No, not yet. Documenta came in, like, I went to Documenta in April 77 and was there until the end of September with Beuys, with the honey pump.
I interrupted. Maybe we'll get to that. So maybe go back to, you go to Germany to help him with a particular installation that wasn't documented at that point.
It wasn't documented yet, but when he did the honey pump at Documenta 6, I did an anti-catalog based on a catalog that I worked on as a student called An Anti-Catalog, which was a critical catalog aimed at the American Bicentennial exhibitions at the Whitney.
Ooh.
Our anti-catalog at Documenta 6 was a huge hit, and we sold 44,000 copies. And I became close to people like Beuys and other, Les Levine and other, and some German artists at the time. I was very, very young.
So tell me more about your experience working for Beuys. What was that like, and what do you think you learned?
Most
from
of the time
him,
that
or?
I worked for Beuys, it was mostly attitude, because at the time I didn't speak very good English. I spoke good English. He didn't speak very good English. I didn't speak very good German. And so a lot of it was just following, being there. He led by example. He was always on. He was always pedagogically engaged. He's always performing, more or less.
And what did you think of that? Was that kind of... that kind of always performing, that seems to be what makes him, in my mind, and I'd never met him, but, very, very memorable and photographical character. But was that also seen as a pose, or were you able to relate to that? Or?
Yeah, there was an inner motor that just kept him going all the time. I mean, he was going faster and harder than everybody else somehow. And I deeply respected his... social positions at the time. I mean, we were coming off conceptual art and minimalism in the States, and there was very romantic Picasso-based kind of painting going on in France and Italy and whatnot. England was post-pop. I mean, it was the social aspect of art in Germany really excited me, and that's why I came over here and stayed for 4 years.
And were there any conversations with boys that you remember or carry with you in terms of kind of something you pulled from him or the exchange between the two of you?
Well, there's a couple of published interviews that I did with him that I recall. It was more his example, more his... there's so many aspects of, you know, the aspect where he talks about buttock lifting. What he's really talking about is get off your ass and do things. You know, make, do, be active. And don't just sit around thinking, don't.
Right. And was there I've seen small references to sort of, you know, what could be called Christ consciousness or that element in his work that's not talked about too much. Was that something that you saw present at all as part of a...
Yeah. Not Christ consciousness, but, you know, a messianic zeal or whatever, you know, zeal to get a message across, to be bigger than himself. You know, extremely extroverted.
So there's different ways of operating, right? I mean, that's one, right? That's Joseph Beuys. Yeah. It was, right, kind of extremely extroverted and doing all kinds of different things and kind of an extraordinary force. You operate very differently, no? Or how do you feel you operate
totally
in relation to that kind of model?
Very, I work very quietly, very, very slowly, contemplatively. Most of what I'm doing is, you know, imagining, trying to understand the person I'm doing a portrait of. I do a lot of listening. Basically, most of my art is about conversation, listening, trying to understand the person. And then I just have the kind of mind that turns things into images. And, you know, I've trained that for years and years and years, as many artists do. And so ultimately what I'm doing is creating an image, and there's a story of how I arrived at that image, which is also important for the person I portray to hear, to have a link to, like, why did I do that? Why did I use a donkey in a Joseph Beuys portrait? Why did I use a one-armed bandit in a Jeff Koons portrait?
Right.
Or they're much more subtle kind of pieces, you know, that the person who's commissioned the portrait wants, is curious, like, how did he arrive at that image? You know, because they're commissioning a portrait, they want to know, who am I? How does this artist see me? They try and steer me, but I don't allow that to happen, really. You know, I don't ask about, I'm not interested in what their grandmother did. It's not about heredity on that level.
A much more intuitive process, really, for you.
Completely, that's right. I had a great experience. 2012, I was invited to participate in the first biennial in Beijing, and I exhibited the Beuys and a Pike and a couple of other portraits, and the art historians took me out to a temple and showed me 15th century Chinese paintings and said, "This is what you're doing. It's calligraphy and metaphor." That was fantastic. They had such insight, and we had great conversations, which helped me very much the next day when I had to appear on stage with the Chinese artist Zhu Bing for a conversation about our works that we had done regarding September 11th.
Yeah, that's a very interesting historical reference there. That of course makes a lot of sense to you, right?
It made perfect sense, and it helped me to explain things to other people. The calligraphy being the DNA, you know, the calligraphy of our extended body, the body that exists through time, through generations.
It's fascinating. DNA is it's tremendously interesting. I interviewed an artist named Joe Davis. I don't know if you know his work. He still works with DNA. And
yeah.
It was fascinating. I went to Harvard to talk to them and met, you know, George Church, who, you know, still posts what you were doing, but, you know, wrote that book on Regenesis, you know, fantastic minds thinking about, you know, and he was saying that, you know, genetics is our knowledge and the ways to use it isn't growing incrementally. He said it's growing exponentially. You know, there's
it's been
exciting
to me to have been involved with this from the, you know, from the 80s till now and seeing the exchange, you know, the changes. And I've stayed in touch with a lot of the scientists, and I'm not a scientist. You know, they know that I'm not contributing to science, but I'm oddly enough, the first DNA sequence, automated sequence, started out as an art project. And, you know, now it's the basis of all sequencing.
Well, I think artists have a lot to contribute there. That is a contribution. You know, one thing I asked them at Harvard and MIT was, why is there no funding for the arts yet? This guy, Joe Davis, who kind of they let use their lab, you know, there's no funding for
him.
He's
fabulous.
They like, he's great. They find him interesting, and it's obviously inspiring, but the science community still can't, you know, talk about why, you know, that's important.
Because so many of the leading scientists, you know, formed companies and whatnot, or became advisors on these companies that became huge multinational corporations. They became tremendously wealthy and started art collections and had very little interest in art and science. They were great scientists, but they just, you know, they wanted Picassos or whatever.
Right. So I think before we close the interview, I would like to talk about the project that also you're known for, the Red Couch.
Yeah, the Red Couch began photography in the Red Couch in 1979 in New York. I was sleeping on a red velvet couch at my friend, the artist Russell Maltz's loft on Crosby Street in Soho. And I decided to take the couch out on the street and make some photos, and then I rented a van and started driving around and photographing with it. And at the time, I was coming over from Germany back to my native New York, and I was interested in a kind of America project. And Walker Evans had done Americans, and then Robert Frank had done The Americans. So I just made a joke and said, well, I'll do Americans on a red velvet couch. And I did the first 12 shots, took it up to Life magazine. They said, great, we'll print it. And I said, no, I'm going all over the country. They said, okay, we'll help. And it was supposed to be a kind of postmodern piece in that tradition of the America Project, but as a series of kind of theatrical moments, you know, where the couch is posed in a situation, breaking up the whole notion of a documentary photograph. Later, the publisher kind of turned it into a roadshow piece, and it was very, and more entertainment and whatnot. So it was very successful as a book with a text by William Leistheat Moon.
Hmm. Well, it's almost like the family of man too, the Adams book, right? I mean, you know, not really, but talk about photographic tradition books, right?
Yep. I was criticized by Hans Hacke, you know, who didn't like the idea of the red couch being sat upon by Nazis, Native Americans, bankers, you name it, Jimmy Carter, Cesar Chavez. He didn't like that everyone was being brought together in a sort of commonality based on this red couch.
But that was the power of the book. I remember when I first saw the book, and it was...
That was
way before this interview. It was just when I saw that, you know, these different people on a couch, and it just seemed, you know, who else could bring all these people together except an artist with a project like this? They simply would not have come together.
I wrote hundreds of letters to people, and, you know, it took 4 years to do that project, but the big focus was on the quality of the images, quality of the photography. It was early 80s, you know, everybody was shooting large format or street photography. Large format was mostly on negative, you know, people capturing light, Joel Meyerowitz, people like that. It wasn't as, the social tradition was documentary in photography. And I went against that norm by throwing the couch in the middle of these situations.
But it also had tremendous emotional and psychological force to it, which even some of these others, and, you know, Robert Frank is extraordinary, and these are great artists you're mentioning,
yeah,
and photographers, but yours had, you know, in some way, it almost transgressed this kind of art book into something that reached out to popular culture, where you could flip through it at a Barnes & Noble, and it was wowing without needing to have an aesthetic sense of photography, even, you know? I mean, as much as I don't mean to say, like, pearls before swine, but I mean, it's
sure,
reaching out, it's communicating to a mass audience in a way that a lot of the books you mentioned
totally did.
Right?
I got a tremendous amount of appreciation with television, with other, you know, repeat magazine articles. It really, you know, burst into American consciousness in a pretty deep way, and in advertising and serious photography and a lot of different branches of graphics.
Well, and also exciting that a magazine like Life, you know, would back something like
great.
That. You know?
They were fantastic. It's John Lowengard and Bob Ciano. Bob Ciano was the art director. And they were very helpful. Staun magazine in Germany also were tremendously important to that project. It all had to be financed. The project cost $200,000. I had to earn all that money, you know, with other photography projects to be able to do it.
I mean, for the four years, that's what it cost, essentially?
Yeah. Every shot cost at least $1,000 to photograph with film development. I mean,
But
so
Life
much
was
help,
paid
though.
For that? They actually helped
no,
you fund
Life,
all that? Or?
No. Life gave almost nothing, but they gave letters and they gave tactical support, you know, but the money came from doing, from selling art, selling other photographs, photo jobs, things like that, debt.
And ultimately the book sold. It was a decent
book
seller.
Sold, like, extremely well, and we were really happy with all that. You know, we made all the money back, and there was an interesting anecdote. I had purchased a Rudolf Stingel carpet artwork, and I had an installation in my loft in Tribeca with the red couch, the Stingel carpet, and I had a vacuum cleaner, a Hoover vacuum cleaner that Jeff Koons had given to me, but had been used. One day, Arthur Danto stopped by and said he could vacuum the Stingel carpet in front of the red couch with a Koons vacuum cleaner. The transformation of the commonplace being Arthur Danto's big contribution.
That's fantastic. So, and did he do that?
He did that. Yeah, he came by, he did that. And here in my studio in Frankfurt, I have the original Koons vacuum cleaner from that new Hoover series. It's a fallen virgin vac. It's completely filthy. And Jeff had a huge retrospective here in Frankfurt, so people like to stop by and look at it and get a bit of a laugh. But, you know, Arthur Danto saw it still philosophically and, you know, and also had a bit of a laugh.
And so now, looking forward to the future, you're going to continue to make DNA portraits. And is there anything else that's happening where you're traveling to? You're basically in the south of France, but you're
quickly in the that's south where of my France. Home is. That's where my house is. My kids are at the moment. Two of them are there. But the right now, the next project is this collaboration with Charlemagne Palestine. I've photographed these stuffed animals that he's been traveling with for 30, 40 years and playing music to. It's been strange kind of going back to traditional photography and trying to capture the soul of not someone, but something, which is a stuffed animal, which can be very meaningful for some people. But it's not exactly like capturing the human spirit. There's a bit of humor in it. And we'll be doing some performances and whatnot with that.
Well, look forward to that. And there's, of course, links on the interview where people can follow you on other ways. But, Kevin, I want to thank you for being with us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Brandon.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIVC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.